Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
There's a sort of universal and ancient fascination with sport, with a kind of mixture of athletic prowess and the notion that you do it against someone. I mean, I remember talking about this with a famous dancer and choreographer in England called Michael Clark, who's a great football fan. And we were discussing kind of the body and what it can do. And then I said, and now just imagine doing all of that on the stage with a team of dancers dancing to stop you. And he kind of went, oh yeah, I forgot about the other team. So I think the conflict and the competition is crucial, and the art as well. So it's, you know, art and conflict for a shilling, the saying used to go in England.
I'm going to experiment a little here. I have been happy to share slivers of my life and past experiences on this podcast, as you know. But I've got to be honest, I know nothing about football. American football, yes. I became well-versed as I waited tables and realized if I worked shifts on draft days and Monday nights when the Eagles played, my tips increased. Through osmosis, I began to understand positions, players, rules, ranking. However, since I moved to England, despite expressing an interest to learn, I am completely clueless. My partner is obsessed. He's a sweetheart for not forcing me to watch it, but I know when a match is on, because instead of watching Minions for the millionth time with our children, he's got his earbuds in watching the match on his phone. When his WhatsApp begins to explode, I know he's not having an affair. It's his fantasy football league. Football may not be on the flat screen in my home, but it lingers in the air. I watch my partner's expressions and know if his team is winning or losing. I can chart the beginning and end of the seasons based on his screen time. And now, after dinner, all my son wants to do is kick around the football in the garden with his dad. I don't live under a rock. When the Euros and the World Cup is on, of course, I watch. I follow the little white dot being kicked around on that huge green landscape. And I get winded seeing these people running laps back and forth, back and forth. I know some key players too. Megan Rapinoe, David Beckham, Lionel Messi. And when I was still working in news, I knew the death of Diego Maradona was so important to so many people around the world that time would just stop. and that headline would linger. Marcela Mora Iorehu is a football journalist who specializes in South American and Argentinian football. She translated Maradona's autobiography, El Diego, into English and has met the legend in person. When I decided to make this episode, I knew there was no better person to educate me on what makes football so accessible, why people become so obsessed with it.
It's a very simple game. It's a very straightforward. There's only something like 17 rules, and anyone can play it, and you don't need anything to play it. And that's, I think, crucial to its mass popularity around the world. So you don't actually even need a ball. You could just, you know, scrunch up some old papers or bits of cloth. It's incredibly straightforward to understand why it's so popular and so meaningful. And then you have the tribal aspect, so the kind of the way it can carry groups of people in support or adversity to other groups of people, whether it's international games, which the very, very oldest of which was played between England and Scotland, and the second very, very oldest of which was played between Argentina and Uruguay, or club football, which is actually the bigger popular game in the world, I won't dare to suggest. There's a wonderful Argentinian writer called Juan Sasturain, who calls it the infinite game. It doesn't ever stop. Even if you lose a game or you get knocked out of a tournament, it doesn't stop. You just go back in the next season, the next tournament. And the grassroots, which is actually how most people enjoy football, whether it's just playing in their spare time or watching lower league clubs, or aside from a handful of elite top flight male players, most footballers either have another job or quite a modest salary.
The best things in life are the simple things. It is human nature to complicate them. Diego Maradona loved football. No, he lived, breathed, sweat, bled football. That's why he is a legend and arguably the greatest player in the sport. His meteoric rise and fall was not a result of the game, but the outside influences that distracted him from what he loved. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. Diego Armando Maradona was born in Lanús, Buenos Aires in October 1960. His family home was a shack in Villa Florito, a shanty town with a reputation of being one of the most dangerous in the city. His father, Diego Sr., was a laborer in a bone meal factory. His mother, Dalma, came from an impoverished family background in southern Italy. The family called her Tota. She was a devout Catholic who doted on her eldest son after having three daughters. He was reminded daily of his responsibilities to his family. On his third birthday, his uncle Cirilo gave him a leather football, and he would play with the neighborhood kids between salvaging scrap and selling it in the dirt roads.
He was from an incredibly poor and humble background. He was incredibly talented. He played keepy-uppy between games and at halftime in bigger matches when he was just a child. So he was on TV, on TV shows, showing his skills. He was interviewed as a tiny little boy saying, "What's your dream?" And he said, "My dream is to win the World Cup."
Diego's skills were exceptional. When he was 8 years old, he caught the eye of a trainer for the Cebolitas, the youth team of the Argentinos Juniors. Francisco Cornejo was shocked by his talent. He said he seemed to come from another planet.
Yes, I mean, I think recruiting children is part and parcel of the industry. in Argentina especially, children start much, much younger, 5 or 6. There's touts going around everywhere looking for talent. There's a very organized system of child and adolescent development. So they have a lot of small clubs, smaller pitches, smaller balls, but organized tournaments. And then at the age of about 9, they might become attached to a club's child division so that they can, you know, progress through the ranks. It's the same everywhere. In Argentina, it's just particularly well organized. And of course, there's enormous pressure on these children because families, entire neighborhoods pin hopes on the most talented players. But if you talk to anyone that's seriously involved, they'll say out of 200 in any generation, maybe 2 will make it to actually playing, you know, in any sort of serious way. I think some of the very interesting people that have emerged in Argentinian football over the last 50 years or so have been exactly the youth trainers and even managers with an interest in youth who have taken this on board and considered a whole a rounded education just as important as the sporting education, because it's a country with extreme levels of poverty, and in puberty bodies change and a lot of things happen. So a lot of the kids who were superstars at 9 or 10 or 11, by the time they're 15 or 16, it's clear they're not going to make it. It's specifically that group, which is enormous, needs to have options. Elite players have to sacrifice enormous amounts in terms of social life, dating, partying, all the things teenagers do. And it's not everyone that can do that. There isn't a whole rounded education. There isn't support. It's incredibly hard to finish high school and be an elite athlete. And in fact, we tend to encourage the talented athletes to not pay so much attention to education, because it will take valuable time out of training. And that I believe that's a kind of tightrope that we ought to keep an eye on as a society, because, you know, we're not helping anybody by just generating generations of frustrated young men or young women as well.
In 1974, Maradona won the youth championship in Cordoba. Soon after, he had his first contract with Argentinos Juniors, who promoted him to the main team.
I don't think he had an education, and I don't think he had a backup plan, and I don't think he had any kind of support at all from anyone. I think he was always the support for everyone around him. I believe that very strongly. I think he was, from a very young age, the entire community, family, everyone just totally relied on him. It's not just the money, but the fame, the glamour, the pulling them out of poverty, pulling them out of the slum, for want of a better word.
10 days before his 16th birthday, he made his professional debut. He scored his first top-flight goal 25 days later, and immediately became a teenage sensation. Over the next 5 years, he contributes to 116 goals and becomes the leading scorer.
Gets purchased by Boca Juniors, which is a very big club in Argentina, emblematic. It's the club he supported throughout his life. We Boca fans, because that's where I happen to have been kind of introduced football culture, really relished him being there. It was on the back of Argentina's first World Cup win in 1978, where Maradona had been a member of the squad that played some of the international games prior to the World Cup, but then was dropped from the final squad by manager Menotti. Maradona was only 17, and Menotti had a different idea. Maradona was already very well known and considered one of the best, and he for years said that was the worst thing that ever happened to him in his life, was not being included in the 1978 squad. But then Menotti did something very unusual for Argentina, which is after winning the World Cup with the first adult male team, he took on the youth team. Generally, the youth divisions were managed by somebody perhaps appointed by the main team manager or friend or... but it was a kind of considered a stepping stone to the adult first team. Menotti steps down, as it were, to take the youth international squad to the World Cup in Japan, and he has Maradona in that team, and they win the World Cup in 1979, the youth category. And I, growing up in Argentina, had this kind of 1978 World Cup victory, which was huge in sort of social terms and everything it meant. And then the 1970 World Cup, which we all watched avidly. We'd get up at 7 in the morning before school and watch the games. And so by the time Maradona goes to Boca after this, he is a sensational, huge player. He isn't, it's not like some kid that grew up in Boca that nobody's heard of. He's already a megastar, and he's already a complete hero in Argentina. And we all love him, and we've been watching him for years, and we know exactly who he is and what he's about.
When it comes to home insurance, Geico works for you. And since I'm the Geico Gecko, I work for you too.
Hey, Gecko, could you DJ my workout?
I got you, Derek. I know you like them sweet beats on leg day. Great home gym, by the way.
That's fire, Gecko.
I call this remix, bundle your home and car insurance so you can save and get coverage that grows with you.
Oh, yeah, rolls right off the tongue. And you know what else I like? Let Geico work for you. Get more with Geico.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Maradona scored 28 goals in 40 appearances with Boca. The club won the Argentina Primera División Metropolitano in 1982, the same year Diego appeared in his first World Cup in Spain.
The 1982 World Cup, which comes, it's sandwiched between the 78 and 86 victories, which was played in Spain, which was a very difficult World Cup for Argentina. It was in kind of occurring parallel to the conflict over the South Atlantic islands, called the Falklands or Malvinas. A lot of the players were of conscription age or had friends and family that maybe were called up to the front. They didn't know really what was happening. The military dictatorship that was in power in Argentina was lying to the people. Most of the players started to find out what was really going on in the South Atlantic when they were transported one flight from Buenos Aires to in Brazil. They had to, you know, switch flights to go from Brazil to Barcelona, and there they started reading papers and seeing things. And also Menotti was still the manager, and he was on a bit of a high from 78 and 79, and therefore he was more lax and less kind of super rigorous. And so again, you know, partying and girls and booze, it was just a very chaotic and disorganized World Cup, where the expectation that it was the 78 champions plus Maradona was enormous. And I think it's the beginning of Maradona realizing how much is on his shoulders in terms of symbolic expectation from the nation. And he can't do it. He really can't. And so he lashes out. He punches a Brazilian player thinking he was another player. And it's a kind of huge fiasco, not a little bit, but people in Argentina still find it hard to kind of really say that was a really badly conducted World Cup by Menotti or whatever. But I don't have any qualms in saying it. I think it was a shambles. And I think Maradona paid the price of a lot of that. I mean, either people made him responsible or he felt responsible or whatever. But it was a sore defeat. And it completely fueled the special sort of significance of revenging that somehow in 1986.
By a curious twist of fate, Barcelona pays a world record amount to Argentina for the 21-year-old football sensation. The whole of Argentina was outraged.
So the Barcelona transfer, which I remember was for $6 million, and we all used to watch a sci-fi kind of TV serial that was called the Bionic Man, but I think he in the States was actually called the $6 Million Man. But so we, you know, this was Maradona was our bionic man. And it was a massive transfer at the time. And it was, like international transfers often are, quite conflicted between people wishing he'd stay at Boca. Why do all our good players have to go, you know, to big money Europe and so on? And people who thought this was terrific because he was going to shine and develop his career on the world stage. It was a huge deal. It was really discussed. It was, it was commented in the press. And it is indeed where he, Maradona, the character that he then becomes, starts to shape, where he starts to have issues with, you know, confrontations with power, within the club administration and the president, dabble in drugs and this kind of superstar lifestyle, you know, with going out, partying, lots of cocaine, and also where a lot of his extraordinary football skills also come to shine. The foundations of the character he's going to become truly formed in Barcelona. He was having problems because he was consuming cocaine and it was sort of known. And that was going to grow into a thing in Barcelona, as well as him smashing the president's office up and generally being badly behaved.
Maradona's time with Barcelona is similar to how a lot of young people behave when they leave home for the first time. They get a bit carried away. Today, it would be well documented in social media. Back then, he was being watched like a hawk by the paparazzi. Despite his bad behavior, he scored 38 goals and was awarded the 1983 Copa del Rey Winner's Medal.
One of the things that Maradona does say about his time in Spain in his autobiography, he discovers in Spain that his ankle rotation is above average. So, you know, he can rotate his ankle more than most people. And I think you can sometimes actually see it if you zoom in close enough to the game. But then I sort of, looking at him at various stages of his life, realized that, his whole body can rotate more than average. So his thighs, hips, he can't quite do 360 with his whole head, but almost. But certainly his peripheral vision from those who have looked at it. So the seeming kind of super excessive ability to twist is particularly useful with a ball, because you know you can then do this sort of things that he did. You know, sometimes it feels like he's a sort of an infinity symbol or a Mobius strip, and him and the ball are just forever encircling. That is specific to him.
Over the 2 years with the team, Maradona over imbibes in cocaine and alcohol. His debts grow, and he frequently argues with the club president, Josep Luis Núñez. The nail in the coffin was when Diego started a mass brawl at a match against Athletic Bilbao. The fight was on the field in the 1984 Copa del Rey final, in front of Spain's king, Juan Carlos. That was Maradona's last game with the club.
Everything in him was done to excess and was never regulated by some kind of societal nicety or protocol or etiquette filter. It's very difficult sometimes to convey quite how extreme his bad behavior was, and particularly to convey why, even or in spite of it, people still love him and think of him as a hero, because he really had behaviors that you wouldn't tolerate in anybody, but it, with him somehow we do. And I think moving away from Barcelona was just a given. He was already on a route to club hopping and seeking better deals and a better fit for his, for the person he wanted to be or felt he could be. Napoli was a natural home for him.
Napoli paid a 6.9 million transfer fee to pull Maradona out of Barcelona's nets, breaking his previous record. Even with a patchy personal life and a short fused temper, his skills were undeniably valuable.
He identified with the poverty of the place, with the southern Italian lack of rules and the nightlife and all of that. And I think he knew he could shine in that club. But there's no question he would have shone in Barcelona as well at some point.
It was the beginning of an undeniable love affair. Maradona inspired the small underdogs to conquer the dominance of the Northern Italy teams. He knew if he was going to make his professional career thrive, if he was going to turn his transfer into a gift, he needed to adapt his style of playing.
So I think Maradona's genius lies precisely on this kind of seeming ease with which he can do all sorts of things, whereas other mere mortals have to choose one or the other. I think adapting to a different pace, different league, again, is something that all footballers have to do. Argentina has been exporting footballers to Europe since the very early beginnings of the game. It's never been a question that you just go from one and play in the other. And, you know, the debate about whether the Premier League has ruined skillful artists. Maradona was a complete artist of the dribble, of the what we call the gambetta, which is the very skillful dribbling around, and then whilst at the same time sort of dumbing them and pretending you're going to go one way instead of another. I think what is very beautifully explained by a guy who knew him incredibly well, Fernando Signorini, who was his physical trainer, Asif Kapadia's film about Maradona, is his own cognizance of what his muscles needed to do going from Barcelona to Napoli. I think that's a very beautiful sequence where both with Signorini and there's archive of Maradona himself discuss this kind of adjustment to speed and control at a different tempo, physically and his reading of the game, second to none. He was physically gifted and talented, and also his spatial intelligence. If you think of football as partly as a chess board, so you have to not just see your own moves, but sort of preempt what moves might come as a result. I think Maradona's reading was really second to none, and continued to be after his playing years when he discussed games. So sometimes he would be a pundit or, discuss matches at World Cups and so on. And it's always shockingly beautiful, poetic and spot on, you know, his analysis of football, which suggests that he really did see it. His spatial awareness was out of this world, out of the ordinary, and his ability to see everything that's going on the field.
If there was a moment in Maradona's career that could equate him to a superhero, it was the goal he scored for Argentina after 51 minutes of their quarterfinal against England in the 1986 World Cup Finals in Mexico.
Maradona just walked away from Huddle then. Maldado. They're appealing for offside. The ball came back off the foot of Steve Hodge. And Maradona gives Argentina the lead.
This moment has universally become known as the hand of God.
There is a moment in the game against England, where Maradona has a huge chance in front of goal, an open goal. The English goalkeeper, Peter Shilton, you know, arguably comes out a bit too far. And the ball is flying up in the air, and Maradona jumps up as if to head it, but actually punches it. And the ball goes into the goal, and the goal is allowed, because we were talking earlier about the simplicity of football. One of the main rules, actually, is if the referee doesn't call it, then there is no infraction. Like, the referee's word law. It's changed now with VAR, but that's certainly what it was like in 1986. The commentators the world over see that it's a handball and say, we think it's a handball. Some of the players on the pitch seem to think it's a handball. Maradona himself looks slightly kind of refrained in his celebration. But immediately, a new move starts and the counterattack from England. And then El Negro Enrique says, I pass the ball to Maradona. And Maradona starts running and running and running and slaloming, gambeteando all these English defenders who are literally left just staring at the amazingness of what he's doing. And then the ball goes in again, and it's a second goal for Argentina. And this entire episode, I think, is like the absolute synopsis. Like, if someone comes from Mars and says, what is football? I would say, well, spend 7 minutes of your life watching those two goals as if they were one single event. It's everything football can be. The dirty, the trickster, the cheat, the sort of... There's no beauty in the hand goal. There's no... I mean, it's slightly cheeky, and it's not... I don't think it's that big a deal, but some people are still scathing about it to this day. But it's not a real demonstration of the joy of the game, whereas the second goal is. It's beauty, creativity, magic. A miracle. You know, I know Dutch people have said that's the only miracle of the 20th century. His teammate Valdano says he runs along Maradona throughout the game, thinking, pass it to me, because Maradona's surrounded by about seven England defenders. And in the dressing room after the match, Maradona says to Valdano, I could see you, but I wanted that goal for myself. And Valdano says the idea that he could see me as well as everything else that was going on just shows that he was almost like floating above and watching the whole pitch from above. And I think comparisons with deity and this sort of reverence that some people have towards him as if he was a quasi-religious figure has to do with this idea that he was floating above us, had eyes on the back of his neck and so on. And I think that is actually fairly straightforward to explain if we just allow the concept of super gifted physical prowess. You know, you don't need to be a god to have very, very enhanced peripheral vision. Argentina beat England and went on to win the World Cup a couple of games later.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
With Maradona as captain and scorer of 5 of their 14 goals, Argentina went on to become world champions, beating West Germany in the final. He was honored with the World Cup Golden Ball and FIFA Goal of the Century in 2002. Maradona's vision for 90 minutes on the pitch was laser sharp. But when it came to the world outside the stadium, chaos swept him away.
But so his move to Napoli is a rare, you know, is in that kind of time, blended by 2 World Cup victories, the beginning of the adult man that is actually a celebrity as well as a football player, somebody who appears in the pages of the gossip magazine, somebody who likes girls' parties and substances, somebody who splashes money in a, you know, almost repulsive way, and all of this. And Napoli was happy to receive such a character, whereas Barcelona was, you know, more traditionally sort of conservative.
In 1987, Napoli became the first southern club to win Serie A. That would have been unfathomable if it weren't for Maradona. The next season, they were leading scorers. They won the UEFA Cup in 89 and another Serie A in 1990. To Neapolitans, Diego Maradona had a godlike status. His image was splashed across the city in shrines and murals. He felt untouchable, and the vices he enjoyed grew and became worse. He became close and deeply in debt to the Naples mafia, the Camorra. His extramarital affairs spread far and wide, and even led to him having an illegitimate son that he refused to acknowledge for most of his life.
So I think one of the very interesting things about Maradona is that he absolutely had no secrets. He was visible from such a young age. He was on the telly. He had cameras everywhere. He once shot at journalists because they were filming with a drone, the swimming pool where his little girls were swimming. He was arrested by the police with press cameras there before the police arrived. So there was absolutely nothing that we didn't all see. He never lied or hid anything. He was complete open book. And he never claimed to be anything other than a hugely flawed and unhappy man struggling with his inner demons. And I think his suffering and his pain and the grotesque in him actually was so manifestly there. And I think since his death, people are slightly treading on eggshells, trying to kind of play down. And I would say the thing that we would most honour the person that he was truly is to continue to describe him completely as he was and not try to gloss over. He had very difficult things to accept about him, not recognizing some of his children being one of the ones I find the hardest. He always said, I'm not an example of anything. I'm not a hypocrite. I think very much elite sports has a shelf life. And when that's over is when we start to face the kind of the issues, you know, the super deteriorated bodies, the lack of anything that kind of can replace the buzz and the joy of, you know, the adrenaline of the stadium and so on. So I think it's a kind of universal issue for elite athletes when their playing days are over. I mean, we're having this conversation during the Olympics where we keep seeing, you know, these people that are way past their prime kind of delight into having one last go. And I think it's very, very hard for the elite athlete to find a life after their prime. And I think Maradona was very much somebody who, when his playing days were over, truly struggled.
Maradona realized he couldn't continue in Napoli, and he tried to leave. But the club was not willing to part with their prized player. His eventual departure was bittersweet after he failed a drug test for cocaine and was handed a 15-month ban from the sport. Napoli honored their prize player by retiring the number 10. Maradona returned to football playing for Sevilla in Spain, but he was nowhere near his physical or mental peak.
The end of the career was the real kind of turning point where he ceases to be the superb best player in the world and becomes a sort of kind of slightly grotesque caricature of a human that can't handle humanity, so to speak, albeit with incredible reinventions and moments of genius too. But really, I think if football was for all ages, he would have carried on playing.
After a brief stint, he returns to Argentina, where Newell's Old Boys and Boca Junior clubs handed him a lifeline after the flashing bulbs of fame burned out. Maradona retired from football in 1997. He was not prepared to leave the sport that made his heart pump every day. Years of playing hard on and off the pitch had taken their toll, and the 90 minutes of clarity he worked so hard for became foggy. His body buckled under the decades of abuse.
The best legacy and the best we can take from that is to truly say, this is what the guy went through. You know, this is like, you can have lots of money and be on the cover of every magazine in the world and be the most famous face in the entire planet and still really struggle to, you know, not have 25 pizzas and 25 bottles of champagne on your birthday, and you could end up in hospital with, you know, gastric inflammation because you have no limits. No limits at all, no control, no self-control.
He was hospitalized after suffering a suspected heart attack and had to have gastric bypass surgery to reverse his obesity. His love and his vision of the game never wavered. In 2008, he was asked to take the place of Argentina's head coach. He secured their place in the 2010 World Cup, only to be handed a two-month ban from FIFA. He secured their place in the 2010 World Cup, only to be handed a two-month ban from FIFA after losing his temper and swearing at the live post-match press conference when they lost. After that, his contract was not renewed. Maradona had several short-lived stints with professional clubs, from Dubai's Al-Wasi to the Mexican club Dorados, before returning to Argentina in 2019. It's inspiring, actually. This man, to some a deity, was fired over and over again. And he wouldn't give up.
So I think he was a genius in terms of his art form, his chosen art form, which was football. But he was also incredibly intelligent and charismatic and articulate. So arguably, you know, if he hadn't been a footballer but had a very kind of excellent all-round education, he might have been a Nobel Prize in physics or something. He was out of the ordinary brilliant. In every sense. I don't believe football tells us anything more than just the 90 minutes of game that happens at any one time. I don't believe it solves conflicts or generates conflicts or changes society or makes the world a better place outside the confines of the pitch. But I do believe that the access to happiness is a right, and that football has been particularly good vehicle to aid joy in humanity. And so in that respect, it's really important that we allow it to happen, to continue and facilitate access to it for the masses, because in, you know, vast numbers of people around the world have very limited access to happiness.
Diego Armando Maradona died on November 25th. 2020. He suffered a fatal heart attack. Despite the excessive vices, the meteoric rise and catastrophic fall from fame, Diego Maradona's status as one of the greatest football players, if not the greatest football player of the 20th century, has never wavered. He is still seen as a divine figure in both Argentina, Naples, and around the world.
And I think in his last years, it all became a little bit too sordid and difficult, even for his loved ones. But throughout his life, it was permanently the same. And so, and if you look at images of him, the physical transformations he underwent, you know, the stomach stapling, and there's interesting times when he reinvents himself, he becomes fit again and charming again and beautiful again, like 2010 when he takes Argentina's team as manager to the World Cup in South Africa. And just before, he had been really at extreme levels of rage and out of controlness and swearing at the international press and being just, some of the players said to me, we thought he was going to die in the changing room. It was really just felt like, what, how is Argentina going to do this? And suddenly he arrives in South Africa all lean and fit with a little kind of trendy stubble, you know, beautiful suits, delights the world. The New York Times writes an op-ed apologizing to Maradona for doubting his brilliance. He's, you know, by all accounts, his press conferences are impossible to get into because they're so overcrowded. He's just superb. He's the, you know, the world's darling, football's best spokesman and ambassador. And that sort of, you know, I don't know how to describe it, that transformation from one extreme to the other, is what we could all always see. So I don't think there's a single secret about him that we don't know. We actually know everything there is to know about him. We know it because he shouted at the top of his voice about it throughout his life. We know it because we filmed it. We had, you know, cameras in his toilet, and if people, you know, I remember discussing with one of his biographers a scene where he describes Maradona's shrink saying that Maradona had a recurrent nightmare that he's sinking in a sort of smudgy shit in a pool of shit, and he's drowning in it. And there's a big thing written up about this. And I'm like, how come his shrink is talking to you? I mean, that to me, that's the first flag, right? What? Isn't there a sort of private code of, you know, that your shrink doesn't go and tell some guy that's writing a book your most hideous nightmare? That happened all the time. A judge, you know, when I mentioned he shot at some journalists with a sort of air rifle, the judge in the case, when it goes to court, the defense team say, judge, please, you know, bear in mind the enormous celebrity of this guy. Can we keep the press at bay? We need, you know, a little bit of discretion and so on. Of course, I understand. Maradona arrives, the judge asks for an autograph and a selfie. So there's no sacred private moment for this guy from the age of about 11 when you know, you find his first sort of fame. By the time he's famous, and then a doctor who meets him around that time says, like, the guy was malnourished. I tried to get him to eat. He's actually about 16 or 17 by the time the doctor sees him. So for at least 5 years, we've all been consuming this malnourished child on TV doing tricks and going, whoa. And as a society, we don't need to look for the secret that Maradona didn't share with us. We need to address everything he did tell us and we did nothing about. We just consumed him and judged him and forgave him, but really we need to start addressing some of the issues that he was like, hey, everybody, this is not okay.
I spent weeks watching old Maradona clips, researching his life, and talking to admirers. I am no expert on football, but I get it now. It touches that child inside us who wants to shed the skin of mundane adulthood. It gives us a chance to be free and focus on something that makes us happy. It unites people who may never have been friends otherwise. It gives people hope. Maradona was the perfect embodiment of what happens when everything you hope for comes true. The downside of hope is we never consider the cost, or if we're willing to pay for it. This is an Audio Boom original production by Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak. To listen to all episodes of A Life Lived, you can follow us on podfollow.com/A Life Lived to link us to wherever you listen to podcasts. If there is an icon you would like us to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @_A Life Lived or @A Life Lived Podcast. You can also email us at podcastalifelived@gmail.com.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.